Hello, you are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to Prof Talk. I am your host, Farha Khan. Last November, the province of BC announced that it would be partnering with the ISIS Research Center at UBC's Sauder School of Business on a dynamic initiative to fund social innovation in BC. The founding and executive director of the ISIS Research Center is James Tansey, and he is my guest today on Prof Talk. James Tansey is an associate professor at UBC's Sauder School of Business. His research covers a number of areas, including the social impacts and acceptability of new technologies, including stem cells and biobanks. His research focuses on emerging international markets for carbon exchange, social determinants of health in developed countries, and the governance of biotechnology in genomics in Canada. But before we begin our discussion, let's listen to an audio clip about Vancouver Green Capital, which is the City of Vancouver's business brand for economic development. The City of Vancouver is aiming to be one of the greenest cities in the world by 2020.
The future, the way I live my life.
Green is contributing to a better society.
The color of our trees.
Generational challenges.
The color of the ocean.
Green is caring about one another.
The color of our mountains.
Possibility.
Connection.
Green means enhancing the natural environment.
Green means wealth.
Green is money.
Green is holistic living.
Green is smart.
Smart. And it's our future.
Capital is a place, a center.
A center of activity.
Capital is a catalyst.
Moving forward.
Innovation.
Relevant.
Creativity. How we make the world go round.
The source for future wealth.
Capital is being in the right place at the right time.
It's business.
Business linkages.
Jobs.
Independence.
Values.
People.
And opportunity.
Opportunity.
It's like air. You can't live without it.
It's a catalyst, and it's what we're going to need to build a low-carbon economy.
I'm Gregor Robertson, the mayor of Vancouver. Vancouver's a great place to live and a green place to live. What people are now realizing is Vancouver's a fantastic place to do business. And green capital means business. But not business as usual. Welcome to Vancouver, green capital.
James Tansey joins me now live in the CITR studio. Thank you, James, for coming in today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we heard your voice in that first clip. I apologize for the technical difficulties at the beginning of it. But let's talk about you and about your role as the executive director of the ISIS Center, because it's so related to what is going on in Vancouver. Tell us what you do and what you hope to accomplish in the short or long term.
ISIS was set up to be a bridge between the university and the rest of the community, with a focus on sustainability and innovation. So it was set up really to take on problems that other stakeholders wouldn't be able to take on, where the university was uniquely placed. And the idea is that we pick those problems, we build teams of researchers and students around them, and both produce traditional research outputs, but actually build partnerships that ultimately help us solve some of those problems. So we've worked on projects like looking at treatments for neglected diseases. We've worked on projects that look at greening the workforce in Vancouver. We've worked a lot with First Nations on the BC coast to try and understand how we can change the path of economic development for them. And then obviously we've done lots of work with the City of Vancouver, as you played in the clip, To try and help position Vancouver as the greenest, the green capital in the world, greenest capital in the world.
Can you define for us what social innovation is?
Well, traditionally, innovation in the private sector is focused on developing new services and products. In the social sector, we've tended to rely on government and the public sector to provide solutions. And at the heart of social innovation is the idea that you can bring innovation thinking to bear on traditional social problems, so long-term unemployment, for instance, or you know, new ways of financing systems for people with long-term disabilities. And so the idea is it's a blend of tackling social problems, but not necessarily through the lens of a business or trying to make the social sector like a business, but bringing groups together, multi-sectoral groups together, to try and reframe the problems and think about them in a different way.
So it sounds like a very holistic approach where you are really working with a number of different people and groups.
That's often the case. It isn't always the case that there's a mix of players, but it's certainly about, you know, taking looking at old problems in a new light or through a new lens. So, you know, trying to reconfigure some of those problems. So with First Nations in Canada, for instance, there's a long history of negative treatment of the First Nations and a legacy there that many people now think we have a responsibility to try and address. And the challenge is that long-term unemployment in many of those communities is very high. And to some degree, the way that the government funds and supports programs makes things worse in the longer run. It doesn't promote self-sufficiency. It doesn't promote independence. Many aspects of the Indian Act in Canada make it challenging for First Nations to fulfill goals of self-determination. So we'd look at that through a different kind of lens and say, well, what would it mean to encourage social enterprise or enterprise in general within those communities? What sorts of problems does that solve? We held a session with Mohammed Yunus and Sean Atlier, who's now the most senior First Nations leader in Canada, a couple of years ago in the Chan Centre, and he got very interested, Sean got very interested in how you might apply microcredit systems in places like the Grameen Bank in First Nations community. At the end of the session, he said he wanted to establish an independent currency and bank for First Nations. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way of thinking about a problem, but what it really says is we need to invest in different ways in those communities and support capacity building if we're going to address some of the problems and challenges they face.
Why is Vancouver a center for social innovation, and why do you think this city has so much potential to lead the world in this area?
Historically, it's been supported by the work of organizations like VanCity. VanCity's community grants program has played a critical role in building up capacity in this region. I think it's just there's an element of just being on the West Coast and a city full of, you know, full of immigrants and full of, you know, the vast majority of people were born somewhere else. They come to it as a place that they see all the merits and great aspects of it, and they want to contribute something positive to that as well. I think there's a creative set in Vancouver and a tradition of taking on problems in a new way that's helped to underwrite that. And then the Vancouver Foundation has been very proactive in this area as well. There's a great initiative funded by a guy called David LePage that supports enterprising nonprofits, which is about building capacity in that sector. So I don't know. I think it's a bit of a West Coast thing, and then a few big institutions like VanCity have made a real difference to it.
Can you tell us about the climate intelligence program at ICIS?
Well, we worked with the provincial government and the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, which is an organization that was funded by the provincial government about 5 years ago. And from the business community's perspective, there was very little material that translated what was emerging out of climate science and climate policy, translating that into something that was solutions-focused. There was lots of material on the diagnosis of climate change and very little on what we could do about it. So we used a model that I'd worked on in Europe, in Oxford, that was a briefing service focused on economic and political issues. We basically built up something like that for climate policy. So the Climate Intelligence Unit, which kind of stole its name from the Economics Intelligence Unit at the magazine The Economist, basically says, you know, what's emerging in the world of research and in the grey literature from research institutions. We write original content and provide that to a subscription list, just push that out to a subscription list. And the idea is just that you kind of build awareness around climate change issues and with a real emphasis on the idea that there are real viable solutions out there to many of these problems. I think we've done about 120 editions of it now, about 40 longer briefings. We produce it every week, and it's become a sort of fixture on the landscape in BC.
Now, UBC's mandate is to turn this campus into a kind of living, you know, laboratory. Mm-hmm. There's a target in 2015 of reducing greenhouse emissions by 33%, and then by 2020 by 60%. Do you think that UBC will reach these goals?
Yeah, I think it's very much achievable. I mean, the 33% goal we're well on the way towards achieving already. And it's being done through a mix of, you'll notice on the west side of campus near the Pacific Rim parking lot, there's a new bioenergy facility going in there, which is the first of its kind in the world. It'll generate heat and power from waste wood that would otherwise go into landfill sites. It's a local company working with General Electric, with GE, to install it. So that's going to generate 2 megawatts of power on the campus and about 6,000 pound feet of steam. That's a sort of model for how for new power generation on the campus. But on the demand side, we're doing a number of projects with BC Hydro to improve the energy use within the buildings, to reduce energy use, to install metering systems, and to do something called continuous optimization, which is, you know, constantly looking for opportunities to reduce particularly peak demand on the campus. So there's a roadmap there, certainly out to 2015. I think the 60% reduction is a bit more of a challenge. And one of the things we're looking at now is how we mobilize the student body to come up with innovative ideas for how to make the campus, to help the campus achieve those kinds of goals.
And we also now have one of the greenest buildings, or the greenest building in North America, is that
That's right?
Right.
Yeah, the CERS building, the Center for Interactive Research on Sustainability, is certainly the greenest building in North America, one of the greenest in the world, and it's not going to hold that crown forever because somebody will be building the next one. It's like the tallest skyscraper never lasts long. But it took us 11 years to get it funded and built. It's a pretty remarkable building. There's some great material on the web on it with a tour of the building, so if you Google CERS, then you can find a kind of virtual tour of it. But it has natural daylighting on every surface. It captures all the water it needs from the roof. It's got solar panels on the outside. It has a system for processing grey water from within the building. And really, it's a benchmark for green buildings. The interesting thing about it when you work in it, it's a lovely space to work, but you kind of expected it to feel like a very different kind of building, and it feels like a fairly, quite conventional, nicely designed office space. So there's no compromise in terms of the interior space. In fact, because of the natural daylighting and other features, it's a really pleasant place to work.
Now, following the 2010 Olympics and Paralympic Winter Games, which was actually, speaking of green, the greenest games on record, you took the role to work as one of the international advisors with the UN Environment Program on the environmental strategy for the 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia. Can you tell us about your role and what you're currently doing?
I was hired by UNEP to provide advice to the Russian the Russian organizers of the Olympics, and we did 3 or 4 visits, a couple of trips to Sochi itself, tour the facilities and tour the site and provide them with advice about, particularly focusing on the carbon management aspects of the games. They committed to run a carbon neutral games, and they wanted us to design a strategy for how to achieve that. So we did. We wrote a strategy document for them on that. Ongoing involvement is pretty limited, and that's partly because the Russians have decided to do more work on their own within the country, and partly just the distance. It takes 2 overnight trips to get there. It's an 11-hour time difference. So from a kind of ongoing research perspective, it's just it's pretty challenging to get to maintain that. But we had a chance to see what they're doing. They're literally building a village the size of Whistler in a greenfield site in the mountains, and really restoring the coastal city that's actually quite a beautiful location on the coast of the Southern Caucasus. So it's a great location. It has some real challenges and problems they're going to have to deal with, but it was certainly interesting to work on it.
I'd like to talk now about Offsetters. So it is a company that you co-founded in 2005, I believe, 2006?
That's right, 2006, yeah.
And you are currently the CEO of. What is your company's mandate? Can you tell us about what Offsetters is and what it does?
So Offsetters is a carbon management company. It's one of the largest in Canada. We created it and spun it out of the university in 2005, 2006, really out of a research project. It was a project funded by Environment Canada to look at carbon markets and opportunities in Canada, and we found there weren't strong quality control mechanisms. So we built a company that said, not necessarily in the early stages because we believe it was going to be a viable company, but just to show that you could establish a high benchmark for quality there. And that seemed like the appropriate thing for a university to do. So we did that. We helped companies like Vancity and Harbour Air go carbon neutral, so measure their emissions, reduce them where they could, and offset them by investing in energy efficiency projects. And the company's grown to encompass a whole range of other areas of activity in carbon management. So we help companies understand how to grow and develop in carbon markets, what some of the opportunities are for that. We do greenhouse gas audits. We've done life cycle assessment work on anything from kiwi fruit to coffee beans. We did the work on the 2010 Olympic Games to measure the carbon footprint and then to offset that as well. And then more recently, we've worked with companies like Nautica, looking at the life cycle of a golf shirt, all the way from kind of production in Peru through to big distribution at Macy's. So the company has employed lots of students and graduate students. We've had a number of MBAs work there as well. And it's just grown up to be a sort of thriving business in British Columbia as well.
Now, you don't just work with companies, you also work with individuals, or individuals can be part of this, part of Offsetters. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there's a calculator on the website that helps you work out your annual footprint, helps you to work out the footprint from air travel in particular, which is a big source of emissions for, you know, relative to many other things, especially in BC, where most of our electricity is coming from, you know, good, clean hydro. Air travel can be a big piece of it. You can also calculate the emissions from driving your own private vehicle. And offset those and get a decal on your vehicle for those. And then there's a bunch of information on the site about, you know, what you can do to reduce your emissions and to change your lifestyle in a way that reduces your footprint. So there's a newsletter with lots of helpful information in it as well. And there's often some internship opportunities there. So it's a fun place to work. It's a great team, and it's been interesting as an academic to get involved in founding and running a company as well, amongst all the other things I do. So it's been a good experience.
I just want to talk a little bit more about how an individual can, you know, offset their carbon emissions, because I went onto your site and I just did a calculation myself of a journey that I take, you know, yearly or once every 2 years. So I looked at going from Vancouver to Buenos Aires with a stopover in Santiago, and it looked at the total in terms of emissions was about 4.04 tons of carbon emissions, and to offset that it would cost me roughly about $80. Mm-hmm. So can you just sort of give us a description of where that $80 would go?
So the approach that we took is that you educate people about their footprint, you help them reduce the emissions where they can, but there'll be a limit to how much you can reduce your emissions. There's no such thing as a zero carbon lifestyle. So we decided then that the best kinds of projects were the ones that support clean technology, so the next generation of clean technologies, and projects which clean up fugitive emissions and things like landfill gas sites. So if there's methane leaking into the atmosphere from a landfill gas site, we're working with projects that capture that and destroy it so that it doesn't have the same impact on the climate. So the idea is that you're educating people, but then where you reach the limits of how much they can reduce their emissions, you offset it, and you do that by investing in the next generation of technologies. And that's been the sort of standard model that we've used for the last 5 years.
And what makes Offsetters different from other companies doing this kind of work?
There's a few things. The first is that we came in, it's an interesting business model, but we came in doing the most expensive and highest quality projects that we could. Typically, companies enter the market with a low quality product and build up. Mm-hmm. We felt strongly that that you had to make these things future proof and drive to get the highest quality projects you could. The second piece that we've really focused on as a company is helping build a story and build media profile for what corporations do when they go carbon neutral. So it's not many companies just have a technical team that does the offsetting work. We have a strong marketing team as well, so they'll help build brand profile and media coverage for a story. When we did the coffee bean story, for instance, we got on the front page of the Globe and Mail, because one of the lessons from the life cycle of a coffee bean from Salt Spring Coffee was that 70% of the emissions come from when consumers grind the beans, boil the water, and dispose of the waste, and only 30% comes from the whole of the production cycle. So that's a great story. That helps sell the product. So we work very closely with them. I guess we've also had a lot of activity with regulators and with a regulated market in BC as well, and been seen as the sort of go-to source for policy advice in that area. But I think those are the things that have made it most distinct.
You're definitely optimistic about our future, environmentally and socially. I can feel that from just talking with you.
You know, I think that if you're not optimistic, then I'm not sure how people motivate themselves to keep trying. I think that as a species, we've survived ice ages and we've survived bubonic plague and we've survived the Spanish flu, which has, you know, had a huge impact on our population. I don't have any doubt that we can make it through some of the biggest challenges that we face. My focus is on how do we make it through well with the least, least amount of negative impact. I came from a resource management background where there was a lot of doom and gloom, and part of the reason I started working in a business school was I felt that businesses had the scale and the opportunity to solve problems in a way that really no other sector could. So I think it's a great vehicle for addressing those problems. I think more and more businesses understand that they have a responsibility to do this. I think every time we solve one set of problems, there'll be new ones, but it's certainly a lot of fun innovating and being an entrepreneur and taking on each new round of problems.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have
you.
Thank you for coming in today, and best of luck with all of the many things that you do.
Thank you very much.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-Sember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
Tune in to the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a 14-hour cross-Canada live broadcast on housing and homeless issues. Housing is a right.
There's no excuse why there should be homelessness, and there's no excuse why people should be going hungry in the city of Montreal.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcast on over 30 campus community radio stations across Canada. Tune into your local station from sundown to sunup from February 22nd to the 23rd, 2012. Or go to ckut.ca/homeless to listen online. For more information or to participate, contact marathon@ckut.ca.
I'm here to make it known that all peoples, especially the street peoples and the homeless peoples, have a right to mass media and do have a right to say whatever they feel is right to get themselves into better living conditions.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is